In 1896, Fritz Hoffmann La Roche believed the industrial manufacture of medicines could play a major role in the fight against disease. And so he founded Roche. Today, Roche is the world's largest biotech organization and the number one investor in research and development to help people live longer, better lives. Roche's 90,000 employees in Ireland and around the world make a sustainable contribution to society through innovative medicines, diagnostics, personalized healthcare, and digital health. We are many, working as one. Roche, doing now what patients need next.
Hello, and welcome to the Answers for Cancers podcast. I am your host, Anne-Marie Fay.
And I'm Michelle Matthews.
Together with some of Ireland's leading experts, we want to unravel what it truly means to have cancer.
From consultant diagnosis to treatment plans, from managing your symptoms to supports available, we have it covered. So whether you're a nurse working in oncology or have been personally affected by cancer, this podcast is for you. So Dr. Harold, thank you so much again for joining us on the podcast. I think when we recently covered renal cell carcinoma, it was just broken down so well and it was so easy to understand. So thank you for coming back and covering bladder cancer with us. I really appreciate it. I might just kick it off by asking you, what is bladder cancer and how common is it in Ireland?
So bladder cancer is cancer that arises from the lining of the bladder. That's what we are conventionally referring to when we talk about bladder cancer. The most common type of bladder cancer under the microscope, or that pathologists report to us, is a transitional cell cancer. It's the 13th most common cancer overall in Ireland, and it's equally about the 13th most common cause of cancer death. It's very significantly more frequent in males compared to females. So it's about the 9th most common cancer in men and the 17th most common cancer in females. And what's interesting when we compare it to those discussions about kidney cancer is that if you look at the most recent figures in terms of the 5-year survival rates, comparing 1994 to 1998 with 2009 to 2013, we actually only see quite a modest improvement in survival, from about 71% up to 74%. But I'd be quite hopeful, based on the most recent innovations in bladder cancer, that we'll start to see significant improvements there. The median age group is 70 to 74. And over 70 of the patients diagnosed with bladder cancer in Ireland are over the age of 65.
Great. And what would you say the main risk factors are associated with bladder cancer?
So again, similarly to a lot of the cancers that we talk about, smoking is a major risk factor associated with bladder cancer. It's also traditionally associated with occupational exposures to certain chemicals like aromatic amines, rubber, or textiles. So that may be relevant for different individuals depending on their occupation. Ionizing radiation is also a risk factor. Arsenic exposure is also a risk factor. And then we talk about a number of familial cancer syndromes or genetic predispositions to bladder cancer, like ORBI1 mutations, the Lynch syndrome, and Cowden syndrome, which is much more rare. And Lynch syndrome, your listeners may be familiar with, because we talk about Lynch syndrome more commonly when we're talking about colorectal cancer. But certainly surveillance for bladder cancer would be part of follow-up for patients who've been diagnosed with a Lynch syndrome.
Mm-hmm. And then for symptomatic patients, what would be the main signs and symptoms they would experience?
So typically painless blood in the urine is the most common symptom that we see in about 80 to 90% of patients. And sometimes that can be quite dramatic, because even a very small amount of blood in the urine can be quite florid in the bowl. Some patients present with symptoms of irritation in the bladder, so that they might find that they're going to the toilet very frequently. They might have pain or stinging passing urine, and they also might find that when they need to go to the bathroom, they need to go very quickly. And then less commonly, in a smaller proportion of patients, they might present with symptoms relating to the spread of the bladder cancer outside of the bladder. And one of the most common sites it would move to would be the bone, and a pain at that site would be another presenting feature.
And does it move to the bone because that's where it's close by, or is there a reason?
Just some cancers, like, you know, the way breast cancer has a predisposition to moving to bone, melanoma likes to go to brain, HER2-positive breast cancers like to go to brain, bladder likes to go to bone, so you might see patients presenting with bone symptoms.
Okay, perfect. And if bladder cancer is suspected, what is the workup that's usually involved?
So classically, patients with blood in their urine will be first referred to the urology service, and usually the first step in terms of the workup would be a cystoscopy and biopsy. You can look for malignant cells in a urine sample, but the definitive test would obviously be a cystoscopy to visualize inside the bladder and to take a biopsy. And then the other staging imaging that we talk about is to stage the tumour to see whether it's spread outside of the bladder. So this would include usually a CT scan. Sometimes that would include a bone scan if there is suspicion on the CT scan that there is bony involvement. And then a CT brain would usually be done to complete the staging.
Great. And then what is non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, and does the treatment change depending on whether you're low, immediate or high risk?
So you could argue that the most important feature about bladder cancer when you're establishing the diagnosis is to determine whether it's muscle invasive or non-muscle invasive. And that's typically defined on the biopsy. So again, going back to that staging, that's a critical step. And this is important because it determines prognosis and it also informs the treatment. So firstly, with regard to non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, if you think of the wall of the bladder being made up of a number of different layers, one of which is muscle, and if there hasn't been invasion in the muscle wall of the bladder, typically the treatment will be more localized to the bladder itself. If it's spread into the muscle, muscle invasive bladder cancer can still be confined to the bladder or the local structures, or equally can also be metastatic beyond the bladder. So we talk about a TURBT, which is basically a transurethral resection of the bladder. So this is typically under the care of the urology service. And often what they'll do is they'll try to maximally debulk what they can see or get rid of the cancer that they can see. And then to go to your question about whether the treatment changes depending on whether it's low, intermediate or high risk, the way that you stratify non-muscle invasive bladder cancer is based on a number of features. So this would relate to whether there are a number of different tumours within the bladder. It relates to the size of the tumour. It also relates to the grade of the tumour under the microscope, and equally how frequent these tumours are being detected. If you have a lower risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, you would talk about this TURBT procedure, and you would consider giving some treatment into the bladder wall. We typically talk about intravesical treatment, so that's treatment that's injected into the bladder, and we talk about the use of BCG, which Irish listeners will be familiar with because of the vaccination schedule here, using the BCG. If you have higher risk disease, so intermediate or high risk, that will dictate how much of this BCG you might use. So you might use it before the resection, and you also might use it in a maintenance setting. And then we talk about a subgroup of non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that doesn't appear to be responsive to BCG. And traditionally, in that setting, there would be a discussion at that point about removing the bladder completely. The difficulty here is obviously that's a very extensive surgery, and as I mentioned, the patients diagnosed with bladder cancer are often in an older age cohort with a number of medical comorbidities. And more recently, again going back to this idea of immunotherapy, the FDA in the States has licensed the use of an immunotherapy drug for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer that is not responsive to BCG. We don't have access to that at the moment here, but that's a really interesting development in the setting of a non-metastatic or a locally confined process in the bladder.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. And we might speak a little bit about muscle invasive bladder cancer, if that's okay.
So going back to this idea of the layers in the bladder wall, so muscle invasive bladder cancer is more extensive locally. It's progressed further through the layers of the bladder wall. You can have muscle invasive bladder cancer that is still localized to the bladder, and it may even be localized to adjacent structures. And equally, with more metastatic disease, you may have muscle invasive bladder cancer that has spread much more distant to the bladder.
Perfect.
And how would muscle invasive bladder cancer normally be treated?
So obviously with regard to muscle invasive bladder cancer, this is a more aggressive process than non-muscle invasive. So the strategy for treatment tends to involve both systemic and local treatment options. So the standard of care for patients who are fit for it is typically a neoadjuvant or chemotherapy before surgery approach. And it's typically based around platinum drugs. The most common drugs we talk about in this context are cisplatin or carboplatin, and they're used in conjunction with another drug called gemcitabine. And typically we would give these usually for three or four cycles before surgery, and provided they're being tolerated, and subsequently there would be an extensive surgical resection of the bladder and adjacent structures. if patients are older or they have more comorbidities, it might not be appropriate to be considering a surgical approach. And then there's a question about using either radiotherapy alone or sometimes radiotherapy in conjunction with chemotherapy. And now we have clinical trial data that are looking at different strategies to try and preserve the bladder, because after you have a bladder resection, obviously you need to have construction of a alternative, which is surgically constructed and drains outside of the body in the abdominal wall. And these are really promising studies, particularly for patients who wouldn't be fit for conventional treatment with platinum-based treatment and who wouldn't be suitable for surgical intervention. And some of these approaches include those drugs that we've talked about before, the immunotherapy agents, particularly in patients who aren't eligible for chemotherapy. We're now also seeing combinations of immunotherapy drugs before surgery. And now we're actually starting to see studies that are looking at a combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy and a non-surgical approach. Now, all of these approaches would be considered experimental, and outside of a clinical trial, they would be considered unusual, because the standard of care here, particularly in patients who are fit, is neoadjuvant chemotherapy before a surgical definitive procedure.
Brilliant.
Immunotherapy is just really changing how we treat cancer, isn't it?
It's completely changing the treatment paradigm. So a lot of those statistics, when we talk about five-year survivals, they're going to be increasingly less relevant. And what you would hope is that you'll see these extreme responders, like in the original melanoma studies, because when they update the survivals, particularly the vaccine study with ipilimumab, there is a tiny cohort of patients who had a really durable response over a really long period of time. And I think what we're all hoping in these highly mutated tumours is that we will be able to have these patient populations where there's this really durable response that persists over a really long period of time. And I suppose one of the issues for bladder cancer patients is that some of the drugs beyond the first line setting have actually been quite difficult to tolerate, with a lot of toxicities. And then again, in a population like the bladder cancer population who have other medical comorbidities, the toxicities of treatment are not insignificant, and would certainly limit the number of cycles that you can give to patients, whereas immunotherapy in general has been quite well tolerated.
Yeah, we see that ourselves, don't we?
Absolutely.
Tends to be tolerated very, very well.
And then moving on from that, we know some patients can present or they progress to the metastatic stage. Do you mind just touching off and tell us exactly what this means and where would bladder cancer normally metastasize to?
So metastatic cancer essentially means that a cancer has spread beyond the organ in which it has started. You can call it metastatic disease, you can call it stage four, but it means different things for different cancers. But certainly the survival with a stage four cancer or a metastatic cancer obviously differs to a very early cancer. About 10 to 15% of patients will actually present with cancer that's spread outside of the bladder. And as we talked about with regard to the symptoms patients present with, common locations for this spread outside of the bladder would be the bones. It can equally spread to other organs like the liver. It can spread to the adjacent lymph glands, and again it can spread to the brain, which is why we would include a CT scan or an MRI scan of the brain when we were doing our staging to look at the extent of the cancer spread outside of the bladder. I would say that this area in particular is one in which we've seen huge developments, particularly in the last year, and a lot of that progress is based around immunotherapy drugs or these checkpoint inhibitors. And one very pivotal study that was released recently looked at the use of maintenance therapy after chemotherapy. So this is after the original chemotherapy, usually about 4 to 6 cycles, where patients who haven't progressed on chemotherapy move on to maintenance treatment. And we talk about this idea in a number of different cancers, and this has shown a very significant survival advantage for patients. And this is great because it means that in the first instance, you are going to capitalize the type of response that you have and you're going to maintain it for as long as possible. And this study looked at a drug called avelumab after platinum-based treatment. It typically has to be administered as per the trial protocol, which was within 3 months of finishing the chemotherapy, and it is currently available in Ireland on a compassionate access basis.
Brilliant. Have we missed anything? Is there anything else you'd like us to add in?
So I suppose we could go beyond. So I suppose first line setting, we talk about chemotherapy and the sabelumab maintenance. And then when we look to the second line setting, we actually have access or at least data for a number of immunotherapy drugs, some of which were given accelerated approval in the FDA, which means that the trial data was so encouraging, they were approved on the basis of very early data. And we have access to a number of immunotherapy drugs here. Post-platinum, we have access to them without any restriction. In platinum ineligible patients, which are a not insignificant portion of the patients, the drugs that we have access to are limited depending on markers that have been selected to predict responsiveness. In that context, we talk about PD-L1 scores, and we also talk about CPS scores. This is a bit of an imperfect marker regarding the likelihood of a tumour to respond to immunotherapy, but these are the criteria that were used to select in the trials for different groups and to characterise different groups. But in Ireland, we have access to immunotherapy in cisplatin and ineligible patients on the basis of different markers depending on the drug we're accessing. But if a patient has already had platinum, we have access without restriction based on those scores under a microscope.
Great.
And these are, I suppose, for a patient thinking about these markers, these are taken at the original biopsy.
So these markers are done recorded by the pathologist. Not necessarily in the hospital that the patient is in, but we can send them externally. And once there's a certain threshold that has been set for access to those drugs, and if it's present, it's helpful because it might predict that there's a likelihood of a response, but that also allows us to access the drugs in the first line setting when patients aren't fit for platinum based treatment.
Brilliant. Thanks for listening to the Answers for Cancers podcast. Please share this podcast with anybody who you think it might help. Also, if you can like and subscribe, it lets people know we're here. You can alternatively contact us on Instagram at theanswersforcancers_podcast. And if you have any questions on anything that we discussed today, please email us at theanswersforcancerspodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Instagram.